Some people are slow on the uptake. I'm talking about myself here. I reckon I only realised about 5 or 6 years ago that I was a cold weather person rather than hot. And it's a fairly fundamental thing, and you'd think it would have occurred to me before then. But no, you can't legislate for dimness. You're about to meet someone who's had to learn how to deal with intense tropical heat and humidity. Walter Mason has a love affair with Vietnam. He first went there in the mid-90s. He's now visited a dozen or so times and learnt the language. He's written about his adventures and discoveries, his falling in love with the country, really. And he joins me now. Hello.
Good morning.
Now, you first went there, really, to meet the family, didn't you?
I did, yes, yes. I've got a Vietnamese-Australian partner. And it was important to him to take me back to his homeland, and even though he came here as a very young man himself. So I went back to meet the folks, and I was terrified.
And it was, a bit, now these days it's a kind of traveller's hotspot, but it certainly wasn't then. And you were kind of in a bit of culture shock, weren't you?
I was this innocent boy from the bush. I'd never been overseas. This was my first encounter with the foreign, and it was a trial by fire, let me tell you. I was right into it.
Yep. So what did you do?
Well, I was immediately confronted with beggars. I was immediately confronted with people who'd never ever in their lives met a person who wasn't Vietnamese. And I found myself representing a whole set of values which I didn't feel I even understood, let alone was able to represent.
Right. I would imagine that would be very confrontational. But since then, of course, you've been back a lot and you've become friends with some real characters, like the hairdresser Kien,
yes, yes.
Tell me about him.
Well, King's a fascinating figure because he grew up in the really the very worst of the Vietnamese times, when there was terrible famine in Vietnam and horrible sort of economic repression. And he was literally a rubbish picker. But then through a series of extraordinary circumstances, his family from overseas found him and his parents again. And he was instantly elevated into the upper middle classes. And he's opened up a hairdressing salon in downtown Ho Chi Minh City, and that's a place that I hang out at when I'm there.
Right. He's, the way you describe him, he sounds a bit loush, actually. He's, women like him perhaps a bit too much. Hasn't worked out that well for his marriage, has it?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. He's a bit of a womaniser.
Yeah. But actually splitting up in Vietnam's quite a big deal, isn't it? It's a much bigger cultural thing than we would find it here.
Absolutely, yeah. There's still a lot of shame associated with divorce in Vietnam. People tend to stick through thick and thin, even though people might have partners outside of marriage, for example. It's still frowned on to be divorced.
Yeah. I mentioned that you've learnt the language.
Mm.
How's that changed your kind of relationship with the people?
Well, you know, whenever I go back, I'm always a little bit rusty when I get back, but after a couple of weeks, my fluency improves, and I find that the prices just absolutely tumble day by day. Things get cheaper, even from the same people. The better I can speak, the cheaper everything is, and that's a plus.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because I think a lot of Westerners, for want of a better word, when they visit a country like Vietnam and they realise that they're being charged a different price to locals, it's easy to get offended by that and to feel you're being ripped off. But it's not meant that way, is it? It's more about class than racism.
That's right. It's absolutely about class and perceived social status. Even Vietnamese who present themselves as being wealthy, who are known to be wealthy, for example, Vietnamese returning from overseas or people from known rich neighbourhoods in the family, are charged more. There's nothing you can do about it. It's a sort of a form of social taxation, and it's a very old part of Vietnamese culture. So there's no point in getting sort of heated up about it.
Yeah. So your trips are not flying visits. One was a 3-month journey with a Buddhist monk.
Mm.
And reading the book, the Vietnamese seem to like you as much as you like them. Why do you think you've made such a strong connection?
Well, I don't know. I think I'm pretty laid back, and I don't get anxious about things. But there's also the wonderful coincidence of the fact that I greatly resemble the fat laughing Buddha. And I tell a story in my book where I was put to sleep late at night in a monastery on a terrace in front of the shrine. And when the young novices woke up in the morning to clean the shrine, they found me asleep there and they thought a miracle had happened.
Because you tell a lot of funny stories. And because you're a big guy.
Yeah.
that is something that they that everybody sees.
Absolutely, it's, yes.
And you're a big Western guy, and you don't have a lot of hair on top, so. So there's this business where you broke a plastic chair because the chair was made for small Vietnamese-sized people.
I often break chairs.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing is foreigners are still pretty fascinating.
They are. We've got to remember that this is a place that was closed for an awfully long time. And even now that it's open, the vast majority of the population is never, ever going to encounter a foreign person and certainly not going to have any sort of relationship with them. Because people, as is natural, tourists tend to congregate in one section and be served by a whole sort of subclass of people. So the average Vietnamese is not going to meet a foreigner and not going to establish any close relationship with them. So I have some wonderful opportunities to really make deep connections.
On Life Matters today, my guest is Walter Mason. He's a writer and he's the author of Destination Saigon, which is published by Allen & Unwin. And it's really a kind of a falling in love with a country as much as anything else. Parts of it are very funny too. And actually, speaking of humour, you have been the brunt of some Vietnamese humour.
Mm.
But it doesn't seem to faze you. In fact, you say you prefer to travel alone because it means more attention.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm being honest, aren't I? That's awful.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think we travel for all sorts of really deep reasons now. And I think increasingly people are travelling for reasons of personal transformation. And I think the act of travelling alone facilitates that. I think that the instant you're with two or more people, you become kind of scary to locals. But if you're by yourself, you're instantly approachable.
One thing I really learnt from looking at the book was that, and I've always thought, because I've spent a little bit of time in Yorkshire in the UK, Yorkshire people are terrific. And if you ever were not sure of what your flaws are, Yorkshire people are brilliant at pointing them out to you, often within minutes of meeting you. The Vietnamese are fairly direct too, aren't they?
Very, very much so, yes. Any difference in appearance, any perceived flaws are instantly brought to the fore of the conversation. And they're, I think it's a way of people who live in very close quarters dealing with each other's faults. So it's all out in the open, so you've got no reason to complain afterward. Everything was stated up front.
And everybody's the same in that way. It's always,
everyone's the same.
It's very direct. The bus driver says to you, "The foreigner looks like a buffalo." Well, he says that to the bus, actually.
Yes, to the whole bus, yes. And bus drivers are forever charging me for two or even three seats.
I enjoyed some of the incidents with food.
Mm.
The anguish of the durian fruit.
What an amazing thing that
is. You
have
to explain what it is. For many people won't have encountered it.
Well, of course, famously in Southeast Asia, some people call it the corpse fruit. It's this incredible smelly thing. And I often wondered who was the first person that ever looked at it and smelt it and thought, good eating.
I'll eat that. Yeah.
I'll eat that because it makes most people run a mile. And I've managed to avoid it. You know, for 20 years, I've managed to avoid it. But in the book, I find myself in a situation where I'm presented with a plate of it by some lovely monks of my acquaintance, and I just have to sit and eat it in front of them.
It's not like, a small plum or a few cherries either. It's quite a substantial thing.
It's kind of the size of two heads. It's huge.
Yeah. But it's extremely smelly.
Mm.
And tell me if I'm wrong here. When you finish it, because you get through it, they decide to give you more.
Give you more. The famous error when you're presented with something horrible, never finish it because you just get more.
Yeah. It really does underline that the local food is not quite what you might think it is if you're just used to going to Vietnamese restaurants in Australia.
That's right, yeah. Yeah. One of the favourite things people have is mum, which is a soup base or a sauce base, which is made of fermented prawns, which is something that foodies might be familiar with.
Mm.
But the extent of its eating in Vietnam is really incredible. And it's something that is actually quite difficult to eat. And I'm constantly being confronted with it.
Do you think there's a sort of certain element of teasing going on here? Let's see if we can make him eat that kind
of
thing.
There is. And I think that happens in all cultures.
Yes.
And one thing I've learned, actually, is to play up to that part a little bit, because people do want you to be foreign, you know. I'm reasonably fluent, but I always say thank you and hello, because I know people will know those two words, and the instant I've used them, they'll feel like sophisticates, because they're using a foreign language.
The other thing that I think really emerges is that it's still a very poor country by our standards.
Yes.
How do you think the Vietnamese people rise above what is really a quite hard life for many of them? Is part of it a very profound Buddhist faith?
Yes, there's an intense spirituality at work all through Vietnam, and it survived the very worst rigors of a Stalinist socialist state, which is sort of loosening up a bit now. And the Vietnamese people
seem to be constantly at prayer or constantly wanting to be in an act of devotion. There are shrines everywhere, in people's homes, on the streets. The temples are crowded, the churches are crowded. There seems to be this desire to understand things at a deeper level than simply the material.
You found that very... That is part of why you fell in love with the place, isn't it? You find that very appealing yourself.
Absolutely. It changed my life. Because I was a very materialistic person, and I was also probably a deeply angry person. And I saw these people who had really suffered genuinely, and I never had, and yet they managed to retain such an amazing spirit.
You also had this, what I understand, is a pretty rare chance to meet members of the little-known indigenous religion of Khao Dai.
Yes.
What is that?
Khao Dai is an indigenous religion in Vietnam, which is an attempt to combine all of the faiths. So it's Catholicism, it's Buddhism, it's Confucianism, it's Taoism, and it's filled with popes and cardinals, and they have a holy city. And their saints include people not just like Joan of Arc and Lao Tzu and Buddha, but also Charlie Chaplin and Victor Hugo and Sun Yat-sen.
Right. That's what's the thinking behind all that then?
Well, it's sort of it emerged in the 1920s, as you can guess from that cast of characters.
Yes.
And the founders said that God was attempting to communicate with the world and tell them that all is one, there is only one God, and that there are a lot of people out there who represent this innate goodness, and these are some of the people they isolated.
Right. Mm. You've actually been to a service or a ceremony?
I've been to many services and ceremonies of the Khao Dai religion, yes, and I was one of those people who found it funny and wanted to poke fun at it, but by the end I found it genuinely moving, and the way they spoke about faith and about the idea of God was quite liberating for me.
It gets a mention in The Quiet American, doesn't it?
It does. Graham Greene was fascinated by it too. I think a lot of writers are fascinated by it, because it's an act of artifice, and yet at its heart there is something quite profound.
And there's one city in particular, Tay Ninh, which is the central focus of it, the central place.
It's the holy city, and everyone in that place is Khao Dai. I never met one person who wasn't.
Right, okay. And you've got these friends, Ricky and Lynn, who really represent those, I suppose, caught between the indigenous religion and the lure of the increasingly westernised life.
Yeah, yeah. They're both modern boys. Ricky's what we call a muscle Mary. He spends a lot of time at the gym. And part of the reason why he can't observe his religion is because there are so many vegetarian days required, and he has to keep his condition up, so he can't possibly follow his faith.
It's 16 years since you first went there, more or less.
Mm.
How has it changed in that time?
The changes are incredible. From year to year, from month to month, that place changes. When I go back, what was once a kindergarten might have become a restaurant. Subsequently, it might be a high school and then a brothel. Things just change at an amazing pace. One-story houses turn into two-story houses and then six stories, and then are demolished and something new is built in their place.
It's interesting. One of the things that emerges is that people will be quite poor, struggling to eat, but they'll still find the money to get the latest mobile.
I think it's really important to them, because there's so much that's shoddy in Vietnam, so much that's jerry-built. Things fall apart. You buy something and it's fallen apart in a week, and that's incredibly demoralising.
Mm.
So if they possibly can, they spend real money on something that looks good and works.
How have you changed? Because it's clearly had an effect on you, at least as profound as the changes that have been wrought in the country itself.
Mm, mm. It's taught me not to be so self-important, I think, and to realise that, I mean, it's I guess it's a Buddhist maxim that life is flux and life is change, and that and if I can't cope with that, then I'm due for a really tough time. It's taught me to accept these changes, and it's taught me to love them, in fact, and to look forward to them, and to trust in the process of human fallibility.
When are you going back?
Soon, I hope. A couple of months.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Walter Mason is the author of Destination Saigon, published by Allen & Unwin. And listening to him does make me want to get on a plane.